Week we looked at Revelation 4 and 5, thinking of the throne of heaven, thinking there at the center of heaven is the Lamb that was slain. And what was the theme of the song of those in heaven, both right now and forever? It's going to be the Lamb who was slain. The cross is the center. And the truth is, if we're not amazed by the cross and what Jesus has done for us there, if that doesn't thrill our hearts, then we've lost something. We've forgotten something. We haven't quite got it. And so to grasp the wonder and the glory of the cross, I wanted us to start our kind of thinking of Easter at this passage. And the reason being because of what I explained earlier. The event of Jesus' transfiguration is told in three out of the four Gospels. So Matthew, Mark, and Luke share what happened on this mountain. And it comes at that same stage in Jesus' life where Peter has just said to Jesus, after Jesus said, "Who am I? Who do people say I am?" Jesus says, "You are the Christ. You're the promised one. You are the King we've been waiting for." And they've seen Jesus do these teachings. They've heard him do the teachings. They've seen the miracles. And they've come to this conclusion. And Peter says, "This is you. You are the Christ." And then Jesus says, "Right, now we're going to Jerusalem. And when we go to Jerusalem, I'm going to be killed." And Peter hears that and he thinks, no. You're the King. You're the Messiah. You're the promised one. So Peter almost takes Jesus aside and he says, "Jesus, that's not going to happen. That's not how things work around here." And do you remember what Jesus says to him? He says, "Get behind me, Satan. I need to go to the cross. I must go." See, after this, we're told, Jesus then takes the disciples, three of them, Peter, James, and John, up the mountain of Transfiguration. It's almost like Jesus sees they don't get it yet. And he says, "I need to show you something. Now let me take you with me, and you need to see this." So can you see, it's helpful as we think about the cross and we start thinking about Easter, how do we look at it? Maybe this morning you think, "Well, I know Christians sing about the cross and I know that it's kind of important to them, but I don't really see what all the fuss is about." Or maybe this morning you feel, "I've just taken the cross for granted. I've kind of got used to singing about it over the years, got used to reading about it, and now it's kind of paled into the background, just into the background, into insignificance for me." Or perhaps it's lost its wonder. You know, it used to be amazing, but now really, well, it just seems, well, I've heard this now, haven't I? Well, this morning I pray that as we look at this passage, as if Jesus comes to us and says, "I need to show you something. Come with me up to the mountain." As he does that, I pray that we would grasp more of the cross. There is so much in this passage. And there is so much that we could look at. So I've tried to strip it down the main things, but there's loads here. So there are things that I might not be able to touch on. You think, "Oh, what about that? Please do ask me later and I'll try and explain what that might be saying." But I just wanted us to have this focus on it this morning. How can we see the cross afresh in the light of this passage? First thing we need to see is this passage, and Jesus wants us to see his glory. Let's look at the glory of Jesus. So Jesus takes these three disciples, his closest disciples, closest friends, Peter, James, his brother, and John. And they went up this high mountain, we're told. Now, mountains in the Bible are really significant. Whenever people go up a mountain, if you think of it, there's something major happens in the Bible storyline. So things like, you might think back to, Ezekiel tells us actually Eden was on a mountain. So the Garden of Eden was up high. If you think of Abraham and Isaac, there the sacrifice was going to be made and God intervened and provided a ram in his place. We see the law given on Mount Sinai. Moses ascends this mountain and there the Ten Commandments are given. Then later on in the Bible, you see Elijah is up a mountain and he has this amazing encounter with God. So when you see a mountain in the Bible, you're supposed to think, right, something major is going to happen here. We're waiting for something big. And as Jesus takes his disciples up the mountain, we're told, verse 2, he was transfigured before them. That was, he was metamorphosized. That's the word. He was changed before them, transformed before them. And his face shone, verse 2, we're told, like the sun. That's the brightest thing you can describe, isn't it? There are not many things, if you look at, they will permanently damage your eye. But the sun, we know, you can't stare at it for too long because it's too bright. And you know that experience when you've been maybe in the cinema or a theatre or in a dark room and you go outside into the sun and you kind of you have to shield your eyes or you think, oh, I need my sunglasses on. It's so bright. Well, they were describing Jesus shone and he was so bright you couldn't look. He shone like the sun. Now, what on earth is going on? His face started first, but then we're told his clothes became white as light. Almost like through his clothes, the brightness of Jesus shone out. His face first, because obviously nothing was clothed there, was covering that. And then even his through his clothes, he shone. Now, for this moment, what is happening is that the disciples are seeing who Jesus really is. They are seeing his real person. So Jesus, we know, is God in the flesh. So he is fully man, but also at the same time, he is fully God. And while he was walking on this earth, he veiled his glory. He covered his glory up so that he could get on with what he needed to do. He chose to hide it. But for this moment, he said, you need to see something. And so he showed them who he really was. I don't know if you've ever seen the TV program called Secret Millionaire. If you haven't, I'll explain the premise very quickly. It was where very rich people go and work in with charities or with people who live in poorer areas in the community. And at the end, they get to know people. And at the end, they reveal, oh, I'm actually this millionaire and I'm going to give you this money to help with your cause. And people are like, oh, wow, you were here among us all along and we didn't realise your fake moustache and your wig. We just didn't see it, you know. But then they reveal who they are to them. Well, here in this moment, Jesus reveals to the disciples something of who he is. Now, how do we know this is what he was doing? Well, again, Jesus is shining. And as he's shining, look who turns up. Verse 3, there appeared to them Moses and Elijah. Now that's strange, isn't it? All of a sudden, Moses and Elijah appear. This, by the way, is a very quick aside. Sometimes people might ask, will we recognize one another in heaven? Well, we see here Moses and Elijah, and they know who they are. We don't know why, and don't think they had name badges on, but they just knew that's Moses and Elijah. So there's some kind of continuity in the next life, and so I think we will acknowledge and we'll know who we are. But that's an aside. How do we know what this is showing Jesus is? Well, because of who Moses and Elijah, what's going on here? Loads of things, really, but here's just a few things to point out. Moses went up the mountain in Exodus, didn't he? And there, as he did that, that was showing something of who God was. And it's taking us back there. But not only that, because we see that we are waiting for somebody like Moses. We're told that when Jesus is coming, we should look out for somebody who will be like Moses. But we'll get to that in a bit. Because remember, Moses went up the mountain. Exodus 33 tells us. Moses is struggling with the Israelites, and he goes up the mountain again after getting the Ten Commandments, and he says to God, please show me your glory. And what does God say to Moses? He says, look, you can't see my face and live. You can't see it and live. I'm too great. You'll just be consumed. And so God hid him in the cave, in this cleft of a rock, and only allowed him to see once he passed. He kind of saw the back of him as his glory passed by. But now Moses is on this mountain and he's finally beholding what he wanted to see all along, the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. And after Moses came down the mountain, we're told his face was shining, but then it wore off. You know why? Well, Moses' face was shining and people were afraid to go near him, but even though his glory wore off. But here, Jesus' glory was not going to wear off because that's who he was. He was shining the light out. So it's a bit like the difference of the moon and the sun. You know, the moon, if you get a clear night and the moon is a full moon, it's so bright, isn't it? But the moon isn't actually giving off any light, remember? It's just reflecting the sun. Moses is like reflecting, he's like the moon, reflecting the glory of God. But Jesus is the sun. He's the origin of it. It's a bit like when I was growing up, on your watch, you used to have a glow-in-the-dark watch. Did anybody have, used to have them? And if you shone it, if you took it out in the sun and then went like that, you could see it for a bit, but then it wouldn't last long. Or maybe you had stars on your ceiling, and if you shine a torch on the stars and then switch a torch off and close the curtain, switch the light off, then they would glow for a bit, and then they'd wear it off. Well, Moses was shining for a bit because he'd encountered just the back of the glory of God. But here we're seeing, here's the original. Here's the source of the glory, Jesus Christ. Elijah had a similar situation as well, because he went up a mountain and the Lord passed him by while he was in a cave. So he got to see something of the glory, but nothing like now. So both of them had these experiences up a mountain where they wanted to see the glory of God, but didn't. But now Jesus says, I'll show you. You see, he's pointing, this is the glory of God. The Old Testament points forward to him. And in case we miss that this is telling that this is who Jesus is, look at verse 5. We hear this voice from a cloud that overshadowed them. So this cloud overshadowed the disciples, Elijah and Moses. And then this voice comes out that says, this is my beloved son with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him. So before going up to the mountain, although the disciples would have been impressed by Jesus, Peter's just been telling Jesus off, hasn't he? He's just been saying, oh, Jesus, you can't talk like that. You're not going to go and die. Almost like he's looking down on Jesus. But here we see, where do they end up in verse 6? The disciples fell flat on their face because of the glory of what was happening around them. Who am I to talk to you? You could think, what Peter thinking? What was I doing? What was I thinking? So see, they thought they knew Jesus, but now they saw him afresh. This is the glorious Son of God. Now, if the cross doesn't amaze us, perhaps one reason it could be because we've shrunk Jesus down. We don't realize how amazing he is and how glorious he is and who he is. He is the eternal, glorious Son of God, the one who has always existed. He is loved by the Father for eternity. The Father is never bored of his Son. And so there's always more of him to know, always more of him to enjoy and experience. In Prince Caspian, one of the Narnia books, Lucy's talking to Aslan because she encounters him. And she says, Aslan, said Lucy, you're bigger. And he said, no, and that's because you're older, little one, answered he. Not because you are, says, I am not. But every year you grow, you will find me bigger. So as she sees Aslan just getting bigger and bigger, it's because she's growing as well. Jesus gets bigger and bigger. There is no shrink in him. There is always more to know, always more to enjoy. Now, do you see how this shows us who Jesus is? If you're not a Christian here this morning, can you see how Jesus doesn't compare to other world religious leaders? They all point to a God you should believe in or a path you should go. But Jesus here is showing us, I am the way. I am God. Jesus seeing here, he's showing us, I am heaven touching earth. Now, what do you make of him? You can't sit on the fence with Jesus. This is showing us that he is somebody so glorious and so wonderful, we've got to bow before him. Notice here, we also see the glory of who God is and who Jesus is within the Trinity. We see the Trinity here as well, Father, Son, and Spirit. Where? Well, we see this voice that comes from heaven, but it comes after the cloud has enveloped them. Now, this should remind us of Jesus' baptism. When Jesus was baptized, he was taken under the water and then comes out, and then we hear the Father's voice saying, this is my Son, with whom I'm well pleased. And what do we see? The dove descending, so the Spirit. We see the Father, we hear the Father speaking, and we see the Son. And here again, we see the Father's voice. And we see this cloud. If you look through how the cloud is used in the Old Testament, it is always there as making visible God's presence, the Spirit there. So as the Spirit is the cloud, the voice is the Father, and again we see the Son. It's almost as if the Father just reminding the Son how much he loves him, says, keep going. It's the cross that's coming soon. Keep going, Son. So can you see, this is showing us just a glimpse of who Jesus is, because we're seeing the Father loving the Son by the Spirit, and we're seeing it in reality. This is what has happened for eternity. And when you become a Christian, do you know what happens? We are given the Spirit. And Jesus wants us to know the same love that he has enjoyed for eternity, the love of the Father by the Spirit. So those moments when you're a Christian where you just feel you know God's love, that's the Spirit at work. And we pray, don't we? Lord, please would you assure me of your love. Please would you help me by your Spirit to know more of who you are. This is how Romans 8 puts it. You do not receive the spirit of slavery to fall back into fear, but you've received the spirit of adoption as sons, by whom we cry, Abba, Father. The Spirit himself bears witness with our spirit. We are children of God, and if children, then heirs. Today, if you're a Christian, remember you're in Christ, and you are loved with the same love that the Father loves the Son. And so today, God says to you, you are my child, my beloved child, and with you I am well pleased. That's the love that we're going to experience from God. So the first thing, to grasp the cross and how the disciples were missing and misunderstanding the cross, because they hadn't seen the glory of Jesus. That's the first thing, the glory of Jesus. The second thing that this passage shows is the mission of Jesus. Now we see the mission of Jesus, why Jesus came, in a few ways. One was because of these people, Moses and Elijah, who appeared to them. Now, as I said earlier, there's two really important prophecies in the Old Testament about Jesus coming, about the promised one. Deuteronomy 18 says, there's going to be one like Moses who will come. And in Acts 3, they tell us the one who's going to be like Moses was Jesus. He's the promised one. So they've been looking out for somebody like Moses. And also we're told, when the Messiah comes, you need to look out for somebody like Elijah. You need to look out for Elijah, because Moses and Elijah together, then we're going to see this is going to be the promised one. So there they are, up the mountain, and they see Moses and Elijah, and so it should be, right, Jesus is the one. He's the promised one that we should look out for. Jesus was the fulfillment of the Old Testament. All the prophets, like Elijah, all of the law that Moses represented, fulfilled in Jesus. The whole of the Old Testament was pointing forward to this person, to this point. Can you see that this is showing that Jesus didn't just turn up out of nowhere? Jesus didn't just show up and say, I'm going to decide to be the Messiah. There's always been the story on the plan all along. Moses and Elijah there were God's way of showing this is who he is. This is what it's all about. But also on the mountain, something really interesting happens. Because here is Jesus on the mountain, his glory is revealed, and then we think of what Moses and Elijah went through on previous experiences. They couldn't, they weren't allowed to see the glory of God because it was too great for them. It was too glorious. So they were limited in what they could see. But now, you know, God says, if you see me, you'll die. But now they get to see him in his glory through the Son. So how? How can they approach God? How can they be this near to the glory without being swallowed up? Well, this is why Jesus came. This was his mission, to make it possible for sinners to draw near to God. In 1986, the Chernobyl nuclear reactor went into meltdown. You might have remembered it on the news. Radioactive particles spread across Europe, and the radiation was dangerous. So what did they do? They wanted to protect people, and so they made this massive steel and concrete structure. And they put it over Chernobyl to try and encase it, to try and contain the radiation, because otherwise it was dangerous. When it comes to the presence of God, there's this radiation in one sense. There's this danger, because if we go near to God in his holiness, and in our failure, in our sin, we will be destroyed. He's a consuming fire. So in the Old Testament, God said to Moses, I want you to build something that's going to contain something of who I am so that people can come near. And that was the tabernacle. That was a bit like the shelter. That was a bit like Chernobyl's encased thing, just to protect the people from the glory and the greatness of God. And when they did that, how did they know God was present? The cloud descended on the tabernacle. So the cloud was there on the mountain here should make us think of that. This is the cloud descending. But these people aren't consumed. They're safe. Why? Because Jesus made it possible. And Jesus makes it possible for us to approach him, to be reconciled to God. Jesus is fully God and fully man. And so he makes it possible for mankind and God to be united together as we were created to be, all through Jesus. So his mission is made possible here and shown, wow, we can approach God. We can get to know him face to face, like in the Garden of Eden, like we were created to be. Jesus came to make it possible. This is his mission. So this morning, if you feel I am longing for more, there's something missing and I can't seem to find out what it is, it's because the reason you exist is to know and enjoy God, and nothing's going to match that in this world. Only he can fill us. And Jesus is the access that we need. He's the one who makes it possible for us to know this glorious God, this eternal God we can get to know and have our lives filled with. And if you're a Christian this morning, what a privilege we have. We can access the living God. We can talk to him. We can spend time with him. We can enjoy him. I wonder, have we taken him for granted? Have we taken what Jesus did for us on the cross? As he died, he was making it possible for us to access the holiness, the greatness of God. Remember what happened as Jesus died on the cross? The curtain in the temple was torn from top to bottom, meaning, well, we have access now to this glorious, consuming, all-consuming fire. Jesus made it possible for us to come close. So can you see, it shows us the glory of God. It shows us the mission of Jesus. But the third thing it shows us is this. It shows us the suffering of Jesus as well. Now, before they come up the mountain, Peter has made this huge statement. He says, Jesus, you are the promised one. You're the Messiah. You're the one who's come to fix the world. And in Peter's head, that is, you've come to crush the enemies. You've come to destroy them all. And this is going to be wonderful because I'm mates with Jesus. And he is going to crush them all in victorious greatness. And Jesus says, now I'm going to Jerusalem to die. And Peter just can't get that. It's like, no, glory means crushing enemies, Jesus. Glory doesn't mean dying. Peter says, no way, losing doesn't mean glory. And here a similar thing comes up. Here are Moses and Elijah. They appear with Jesus and Peter is starstruck. He doesn't know what to say. Do you notice what he says, verse 4? And he said, oh Lord, it's good that we're here. This is good. I'm so pleased. There's Moses and Elijah. He's starstruck. Wow, let's get some tents. If I get 3 tents, we can stay here. We can stay on the mountain. It's almost like I don't want this moment to go. Let me take a selfie. I want us everybody to see this. I want to stay here in this glory. And Jesus realizes, no. This is not where I'm staying. I need to go down the mountain. I need to start the journey to the cross. Because it's when Peter is saying, this is what I want. Glory, fame, Moses, Elijah, this is it. And as he's talking, God the Father interrupts him and says, this is my beloved son, verse 5, with whom I am well pleased. And listen to the last bit. Listen to him. Listen to him. What has he just told you? He's going to the cross. The path of glory is one of defeat. The path of honor is one that's going to have to go through the darkness. This is the way he has to go. The suffering of Jesus was underlined really here. And what was happening next? Because remember we said about mountains in the Bible being important? Well, the next 2 mountains that Jesus goes up is such a contrast to this mountain. One of the mountains he's going to go up, as we read on in Matthew's Gospel, is the Mount of Olives. Somewhere he went often with the disciples. They'd wander up that mountain. It's where the Garden of Gethsemane is. And so there, can you see the similarities here? He takes 3 disciples with him again. And there again, he has this conversation with his father. And there again, the gospel writers point out his face. But this time it's not shining with glory. It's full of agony and it's sweating drops of blood. No longer is he enveloped in the love of the Father by the Spirit, but it's almost as if there's a coldness and a distance in the Gethsemane garden. He knows that soon he's going to be forsaken. And the guests there aren't the esteemed Elijah and Moses, but the guards that are coming to arrest him, led by the betrayer, Judas. That's the next mountain we'll see Jesus going up. But not only that, there's another mountain coming soon after, isn't there? Just the next day, he's going to be walking up that Mount of Calvary. And as he's walking up, again, he's not surrounded by Elijah and Moses and the love of the Father, but he's on his own. The disciples have fled, they've left him, and he's not shining with glory, but he's stripped naked, full of shame for everybody to laugh at and mock him. And as he's on that mountain, he doesn't hear the voice of the Father reminding him of his love. His cry is one of, Father, you've forsaken me. Why? Can you see the contrast? The glory of Jesus is now just so so far away, it seems, from this, because it seems to be in the darkness. His suffering here shows us just how far he's come down. But you see, the suffering is connected to his glory. The suffering is his glory. So John 17, Jesus prays. He says, "My hour has come, glorify your Son. As I go through this moment, show the world my glory." John 16 says, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified when I'm lifted up. Draw people to myself." So how is the cross and that Mount of Calvary showing the glory of Jesus when it looks like he's defeated? Why? Because there we see the love of God. There we see his grace. There we see how a God can be perfectly holy and perfectly loving and just by punishing the Lord Jesus in our place. You see, Jesus shows us his glory because that's where he goes. He had all the power of heaven, all the power of the earth. He could have done with it whatever he wanted. And how did he choose to use it? To serve you and me by dying on the cross. That's why John 13 is so amazing. It says, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, Jesus had all the power in the universe at his fingertips. What was he going to do? He stripped off and washed the disciples' feet. How does he use his power? For you and for me. Now contrast that with what we're seeing in the world at the moment. How do people in this world use their power and their authority to gratify their own evil desires? But Jesus did it to serve you and to serve me. That's glory. That's wonder. It looks like defeat, but actually he's doing it for you and me because he loves you so much. There's a theologian called B.B. Warfield, and in a sermon he preached on Philippians 2, he talks about how do you measure grace? Well, how do you measure anything? You need two points, don't you? If we were to measure how wide this platform is, we'd have to start there and end over there. That's how it is. So how do you measure grace? And he says this, you measure grace by seeing really two points, the start and the end. You measure grace by the distance between equality with God and public execution on a Roman cross. That's how you measure grace. How far apart. That's glory. That's how much he loves you. So as we look on the glory of Jesus, as we see his mission, we see his suffering as part of that in order to welcome us in. Now, have you acknowledged that for yourself, that Jesus did that for me? He came into this world for me. Maybe today's the first time you need to do that and realize, Jesus, you've done this for me. You love me that much. You didn't hold on to your glory, but you used it to serve me. Now, just to close, I want to give three things for us to think about, just as practical outworkings of this. So what? And I said, I know there's lots I haven't touched on in this passage. It's so rich and so wonderful. But here's three things that we should do as a result of this passage. The first is this. We need to listen to Jesus. That was the big command here. Peter said, Jesus, you're not going to the cross. And Jesus turns to Peter and says, Peter, I need to take you up the mountain. I need to show you something. And God the Father says, Peter, listen to him. Now, the big thing, that was a big theme here. But I wonder, is there something that God is calling you to do and you're putting him off? You're saying, no, I don't need to do that. Well, Jesus is just, remember the glory and the power of Jesus now. His greatness, his beauty. And he's the one who says to you, whatever it is he's calling you to do. See, we can't just push him to a side. Perhaps the reason we're able to not listen to him, not take that step in obedience, not do whatever it is he's calling us to do is because we've shrunk him down into somebody more manageable. But if the voice of heaven says, listen to Jesus, all authority is his, you can listen to him. Maybe if you're not a Christian this morning, you're putting off following Jesus in the first place. He's just been putting it off and putting it off and putting it off. So Jesus became the small, manageable person who you can just say, not today. But when we see who he really is, how can we turn him away? He is speaking with the authority of heaven. So Christian, what are you putting off? Look at who's asking you. We can listen to him. Listen to Jesus. But the second thing which needs to be held closely to this is you can also trust him. So he's not just saying, do this, but he's saying, do this because I love you so much. How do you measure grace? Look at where it started and look at where it ends. That's how much he loves you. That's how far he's come. He loved you so dearly, and so you can trust him with your life. Trust him with the step of obedience that he's calling you. Trust him with maybe becoming a Christian for the first time, because he loves you. He went to the cross for you, and he didn't have to do that. He did it because he loved you, and he wanted you to be forgiven. He didn't want you to suffer hell. He said, I will take it in your place. But also, as you think on that, you can trust him because sometimes things in our life don't make much sense. As you look at Jesus dying on the cross, as you look at the struggle he would have gone through, it looks like the eternal Son of God, why is he suffering like that? Why is he in the darkness? Why is he going through this struggle? Well, he was doing it because he knew the path of suffering was the path to glory. That means when we follow Jesus, when we follow the path to Calvary, there'll be times where we just don't get what God is doing in our lives. I just don't understand it. Why am I here? Why is this happening? What's going on? But let's remember that through suffering came the resurrection. Through the suffering came the glory of the other side. So we can trust Jesus in the darkness because we know he came out the other side and we one day will too. The path of suffering is also the path of glory. The path of confusion and darkness. So what is it in your life that doesn't make any sense at the moment? Look at it at the light, in the light of the Mount of Transfiguration, because there sense can be made. Romans 8 says, I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing for the glory that's to be revealed in us. It will make sense one day. Jesus shows us that here. Even though it won't make sense on Good Friday, on Easter Sunday, it'll all fall into place. Maybe it feels like you're in that Good Friday moment where things don't make sense. You're in the darkness. Everything seems dead and hopeless. But Sunday is coming. We can keep our eyes there. So the first thing is listen to Jesus, trust Jesus, and the last thing to finish is enjoy Jesus. You think, well, if I was there with Peter, James, and John, and I saw Jesus in his glory, then it'd be easy to be a Christian then, wouldn't it? Well, you see, Peter, James, and John all struggled after this as well. Nothing, it wasn't straightforward to them. It didn't all just fall into place. But Peter, in one of his letters, says, we've got something better than being up the mountain with Jesus. In 2 Peter 1, he says, we don't follow cleverly devised myths when we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus, but we were eyewitnesses of his majesty. I was there, he said. When he received honor and glory from God the Father, and the voice was borne by him to the majestic glory, this is my beloved Son with whom I am well pleased, we ourselves heard this very voice born from heaven, for we were with him on the holy mountain. He said, look, I was there. And then he says, and we have the prophetic word more fully confirmed, to which you will do well to pay attention as a lamp shining in a dark place. He says, you've got something better than being up the mountain. What's that? The Bible. How is that better? Because that one-off experience is something that is now in the past, but every day we can encounter the face of Jesus Christ in scriptures, in the Bible. Every day he says, look, come and talk to me. I want to talk to you by my spirit. I want to wrap my arms around you, as it were, by my spirit, so you can experience the love of God the Father by the Spirit, by beholding the glory of Jesus. All of the Bible is about Jesus. It'll all point us to him, and we just need to get into the God's word and enjoy something better than being on a mountain. That's what Peter says, and he was there. So every day you have an invitation, Jesus says, come and enjoy me. Come and take on who I am. Listen to him there. So there's lots going on in this passage, but I hope this is just something of what's been said this morning will help us to see the cross in a different light. Wow, there is the glory of Jesus. Wow, we see his mission here to make it possible for me to access God, and his suffering shows just how much he loves us. So let's trust him, let's listen to him, and let's enjoy him together. Let me just give a few moments silence as we just reflect together before we sing our last hymn together.